You are listening to WPVM LP 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina. And globally at WPVMFM.org.
Well, howdy, buckaroos and buckarettes.
This is WPVM 103.7 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. Hello and welcome to A Better World on WPVM. My name is McNair Ezard and I'm your host for A Better World. Each week on A Better World, we take an in-depth look at the people and organizations, locally, nationally, and internationally, who are working to create a world that works for everyone. And our guest today is Adam Parsons. He's with Share the World's Resources in London. Adam Parsons, welcome to A Better World.
Thank you, McNair. It's good to speak to you again. It's been a while since I was last on the show.
Yes, I think it was 2019 that you were last on the show, so welcome back. So give us a little bit more information about Share the World's Resources as an organization.
Sure. Well, we're a not-for-profit civil society group founded by Mohamed Sofian Misbahi in 2003. We have a consultative status at the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations. And what we do is we aim to educate the public about the need for sharing the world's resources as a pragmatic solution to the multiple crises that governments are failing to address. So, you know, hunger, poverty, climate change, environmental degradation, resource-driven conflict. So we basically have two main objectives as an organization, which is firstly to raise awareness of the critical need for nations to implement an international emergency program to alleviate mass hunger and poverty, which is outlined in many of our publications and our books. And secondly, it's to campaign for a united people's voice that speaks on behalf of the least advantaged members of the human family, which gives giving the highest priority to the prevention of extreme deprivation in every country. So we can surely talk more about that. And we publish and communicate our books and articles, our writings, we have a website with and social networks. And you know, we do talks. We participate in demonstrations around the theme of sharing the world's resources, and we are involved with lots of grassroots campaign initiatives directed particularly towards the United Nations.
So tell me about the founder, Mohamed Sofian Misbahi, who he is and how did he come to start Share the World's Resources?
Sure. Well, Mohamed is a very interesting individual. He founded SWR in 2003, but he has an interesting background from his not only his political understandings, but also his background with the Ageless Wisdom teachings. So that's what drew me to this work myself, is that it's not just about policies and just the conventional activism, but it's looking at these issues from an inner perspective also. You could say philosophical or psychological, but it's looking at how we are all part of the problems that we face and how we need to have a different kind of activism if we're to come into a better world, a new age, as some would say. So Mohamed, I can't say too much about him. He would have to speak for himself. but that's I've been working with him for many years now. Must be what, 18 years. So he's enriched my perspectives very much.
There's a lot of his written materials available on your website or can be ordered from the site. And I wanted to talk about some of his ideas in our conversation today. But first, I'd like to explore in a more general way, what do you mean by the idea of sharing? If you can get a bit more specific from what you've already said, and why is the type of sharing you're talking about important for today's world?
Sure. Yeah. Well, as you say, we have a lot of sort of introductory material on our website, but we all know what sharing means within our homes, our communities. There's lots of scientific research now that demonstrates how, as human beings, we're naturally disposed to cooperate and share in order to maximize our our well-being, our chances of survival. But where we come from is that we need to really upscale this principle and implement it not just nationally, but globally between nations. Because it's our collective failure to share resources within and among nations that's the basic cause of the many crises we're facing, the increasing inequalities. And it stands to reason that we need to find ways of reforming our political and economic systems to bring them more in line with this simple basic principle of human evolution. So it's from a common sense perspective that we're looking at this. The term economic sharing, it can be used to describe the application of how to apply that principle to how our economies are organized, how resources are distributed, with everything from land and energy to knowledge and technology. Democratic governance also applies to this concept in terms of how equally power is distributed nationally and globally. That has dramatic implications for participatory politics and global democracy. Not least for the major institutions that determine the rules of economic globalization. We could talk also about the many crises we're facing as the global economy is hitting natural resource limits and planetary mm-hmm. thresholds. So obviously, it goes to the very heart of what we need to do as a human race to address the crises that we face.
So you mentioned earlier, I think it was about the ageless wisdom. So I wanted to ask you, is this idea of sharing based on any particular religious belief or religion or that the wisdom teachings that you talked about?
Well, of course, the principles of sharing and equality are important components of many of the world's religions, as well as secular movements like humanism. Of course, Judaism, Islam, particularly Christianity and Buddhism, all of the major faiths expound the importance of sharing wealth and resources fairly, as well as the need to protect the vulnerable, the least well-off in society. Of course, the message of Jesus and Christ was central to helping the poor, the less privileged. But we're not coming from a religious background. We don't need to apply the idea of the principle of sharing just in religious terms. It underpins moral values and ethics that are the basis of our societies. For us, it's not a religious belief, and that's certainly not what motivates us and the people mm-hmm. who are involved with our organization.
Well, let me ask you about, there's an article on the website by Mohammed titled Commercialization, the Antithesis of Sharing, and it speaks about market forces and commercialization. Could you talk for a minute about what market forces are and their relationship to this idea of commercialization?
Sure. I can talk from a kind of common sense perspective. We all know that market forces or the commercialization is a trend that's dramatically accelerating and has done particularly since the 1980s. The marketization of our lives, commercial forces are entering every aspect of our lives through, not just in terms of consumerism, and the products that we buy from supermarkets and so on, but in terms of how we organize our societies, how healthcare is distributed, how food is made and distributed, and the privatization of everything. So this is a trend that is really antithetical to the need to share resources and make sure that everyone has the very basics they need. So it's a pernicious trend, and I think that we may not realize just how pernicious. And that when the article you mentioned by Mohammed is part of the book Studies on the Principle of Sharing, and I think it's titled Commercialization, the Antithesis of Sharing. So he looks at this in a kind of interesting perspective in terms of how commercialization eclipses the principle of sharing. He says, as long as we live in a society that is driven by profit and commercialization, the principle of sharing will always be eclipsed. He says, in every sphere of human activity, it can be observed that when commercialization moves in, sharing moves out. So he looks at this in an interesting way then, also in terms of how these forces affect us individually and inwardly, as well as socially and politically and economically.
It's interesting because as I think about commercialization, I think about the different countries and political systems in the world, whether a country is capitalist, socialist, or somewhere in between, the governments of the world, in many cases, don't seem to be aligned with human need, but with human desire for more, promoting this idea of consumption as the means to uphold their economies. Can you speak to that idea of the governments of the world basing basically their economic existence on this idea of consumption and commercialization?
That's right. You know, and that's, you know, that trend has, particularly since the onset of what we call economic globalization in the 1980s, pushed particularly by America and the major financial institutions like the IMF and the World Bank. You know, it's this idea that we have to continually grow the economy, that nations have to compete for resources, and that we in society have to, to become happy, to be secure. We need to continually to consume and have a very materialistic high standard of living, that we have to, you know, aspire to that. And, you know, there's a lot involved in that process, which goes to the root of our education even. And this is really, I don't think we realize how much that is affecting our evolution as a race, and how, you know, how that the growth of inequality stems from that. And of course, the environmental crisis. We're reaching a point where we cannot continue to grow the economy, consume resources at the rate we are, but we're all locked into this system. We don't seem to be able to find a way out of it.
Especially here in the U.S., I mean, the tentacles of commercialization are everywhere. Healthcare, schools, prisons, and many other areas. I mean, people want things. They want money and the things that money can buy, far and above basic necessities of life. And people want to be happy. They think that acquisition of more will bring them happiness. And in that article, Commercialization, the Antithesis of Sharing, it says, commercialization is very clever in promising us happiness, a good life, a more comfortable life, and security. Why can't this seeking for security, I guess my question is, why can't this seeking for security and happiness within the framework of commercialization work?
Well, I mean, you know, there's nothing wrong with seeking happiness. But I think where Mohammed is coming from in that article is he's explaining that psychologically, what that does is by seeking security, so-called, seeking to become happy and have a good life, it makes us very indifferent to the suffering of others. You begin to live in a bubble where all you are concerned with is your own life, your own standard of living, your own family and friends, and you're not. It kind of extinguishes within us that need to see the suffering of others, the problem of the problems of the world. You know, we all know there's a climate crisis and there's a huge poverty crisis and inequality is growing, but we just carry on this treadmill of working and consuming, and without taking effective action to do something about the fact that, you know, every day people are dying of hunger. 40 odd thousand people are dying every day, and we carry on as if this is a normal way to live. And that's where the root of how commercialization, if you call it a force in itself, is manipulating us, particularly through our education also, wanting us to become successful and compete with others to become a somebody. That's really the root of where we are becoming so complacent and indifferent to the world's ills.
I've noticed it, been aware of it for quite a long time, but I've also noticed it in the past couple of years, and I'm a college sports fan, basketball, where that idea of commercialization has also entered in there now, where sports players in college go from school to school based on what financial benefit they can get from, you know, doing commercials and all these sorts of things. So I don't know if it's the same in the UK or not.
Oh, massively. Yeah, massively. The amount of money that these, you know, big football players get, and, you know, how football clubs are bought and sold by, you know, rich billionaires. And yeah, it's a trend you see in every sphere. But also what we don't understand is how we lose some of the simple creativity and joy of life because of this, and how it's really causing our lives to be diminished in so many ways. And to the point that we're facing, you know, huge crises that affect the future of our civilization And yet we don't act as if that's the case. You know, that force of complacency that is brought about by commercialization, I don't think we realize just how dangerous that is. It's always more fun to share
with everyone. If you just joined us, you're listening to a conversation with Adam Parsons. He's from Share the World's Resources in London. And you're listening to us on A Better World at WPVM 103.7 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. To your friend, if you have three, give one to your friend and me. It's always more fun to share with everyone. It's always more fun to share with everyone. Okay, that's Jack Johnson singing the Sharing Song from the album Jack Johnson and Friends. And today on A Better World, our guest is Adam Parsons from Share the World's Resources in London. Adam, before the break, we were talking about one of the articles on the website, and there's a line in that article that says, "The forces of commercialization are expert in offering us happiness by misdirecting our minds from awareness of the self, which is really the only place where any real contentment or joy can be found." Can you talk about that idea, please, about commercialization and how it diverts us from...
Yeah, sure. I mean, that really says it all, I think, that quote. You know, it speaks to the fact that there's more to us than we perhaps know in terms of who we are, you know, as individuals, as, you know, our inner creativity and our innate divinity, you could say. Yeah, what commercialization is doing ultimately is crushing that. I cannot do justice, I believe, to the piece that we're referring to from the book Studies on the Principle of Sharing. So it's available on our website. I'd urge any interested listeners to go. At the end of that piece, what Mohammed does is he goes on to list the kind of the inner and the outer effects of commercialization on humanity, on us as individuals, which is a long list. But it says, for example, how it sustains mind conditioning, which is pollution to the soul, how it creates and deepens a complex of inferiority in people wherever they are, leading a person to believe they must become a certain somebody, thereby losing their true spiritual purpose in life. And it instills an unconscious and often life-lasting sense of psychological fear in people's minds that prevents any curiosity or open-mindedness about the spiritual meaning of life, and ensures that complacency is sustained at all times. So, and many more things. So yeah, that perhaps gives a sense of just how pernicious commercialization is in terms of how it affects us inwardly, as well as commercializing the outer aspects of society.
Here in the US, I've engaged in conversations with people at times about this idea of sharing. And one of the responses I have gotten from people is, they say, well, what's in it for me? What's in it for them in this idea of sharing? How does it improve? I guess I'm asking you, how can sharing improve their lives if they already have what they want and need?
Right. Well, you know, I think we're kind of touching here on some of the spiritual aspects of what sharing means. And I think as long as we're living these very insular, isolated lives, which is what the present arrangements of our society have led to, is that we don't realize the joy of life, the joy of being, the joy of being together, and what it would mean if we have a more equal society where everyone has their basic needs secured, and what that would mean in terms of how we feel, you know, the lessening of the stress and the tension that we are swimming within, particularly when the world's crises are climaxing as they are. So, yeah, I mean, you know, if we share, what does it mean? It means, of course, we talk about Article 25, which we may come onto, but it means primarily taking action for the least among us, the more deprived among us. It means coming together, unifying, to do something to, at the very first priority, to stop people from dying of hunger. That's what it means to do something to share more in our societies.
As you've been talking, I can't help but think about this idea of complacency, which you've kind of touched on, that it is complacency that's part of the reason that we, as part of humanity, continue to let the world's problems continue. Can you talk about the link between commercialization and that of complacency?
Yeah, I guess we've been talking around that. Again, you know, it's said so well in this article that we've been talking about on commercialization. But, you know, complacency, I don't think we also see how much of a force that is that prevents the changes we need to see in the world. The fact that, you know, even with the climate crisis, which has a massive amount of activism now, rightly so, but you have these demonstrations where there's only, you know, maybe, you know, as a proportion of the population, you know, you might be 1%, you know, you might have 100,000 people out of, you know, 60 million in the case of the UK. It's so many people are not engaged. And yet, from every angle, however you look at it, the only solution to the crisis we're facing is mass engagement. We have to come together and make a stand for the world we need to live in, because our governments are not going to prioritize people's basic needs around the world. They're going to prioritize commercial interests, private interests, and the needs of the stock market, of economic growth. So it's that simple, that unless we, you know, come together, take a stand, which does mean we're moving into an age of mass protest, then we're not going to be able to see the inauguration of a better world, better society.
And of course, the media, to my mind, are the ones that, you know, kind of show us, or should show us, what's going on in the world, but they seem also to be drinking the Kool-Aid in terms of complacency, right, and commercialization.
Surely, yeah. And what we were just talking about, I mean, to become somebody, to have a job, to have, you know, the media don't speak out. As we've seen with the genocide of what's happening in Gaza, the media will just toe the line of their benefactors, their corporate benefactors, those who own their papers or their outlets or the establishment that it takes their particular line. We're not going to see change coming from the top down, from our governments or from the media or from corporations. So obviously the only solution lies with people ourselves taking massive action. And of course, that's not what's happening. Hence the complacency. And it all comes back to what we're seeing with the fact that we are so commercialized that we don't realize what a bubble we're living in and that we're not in reality.
And it's not only the complacency in regards to people that are living in poverty and dying of starvation in the world, it's complacency that also affects, I think, what we are or are not doing about the environmental situation.
Right. Absolutely.
So is there a way that sharing can have an impact on how we currently treat the natural world?
Completely. I mean, it's interesting that in terms of activism, the call for sharing is most central in the environmental movement, particularly at the climate change COPs, you know, the conferences or the parties, where you have this call from the NGOs for fair shares. And that's even been quantified through civil society reports in terms of what actually the so-called Annex One, the rich nation countries need to do in order to share resources and financial assistance and technology with the poorer countries of the South so that they can leapfrog the industrial model based on fossil fuels and begin to, you know, have a sustainable, greener economies, right? And that's been at the very heart of the United Nations process on climate change. So first and foremost, in terms of activism, the call for sharing is centrally there. And we know that, you know, in terms of the sustainable development framework, you know, unless we, you know, the richest nations, which are, you know, the wealthiest 20% of the world population, are consuming what, roughly 80% of global resources, and are therefore responsible for the majority of climate change and environmental destruction, while the poorest 20% lack even sufficient access to the essentials of food and clean water and energy, and account for a tiny proportion of global resource consumption and emissions, like about 1%. So obviously there has to be an equilibration of the economy. The richest nations have to consume less so that the poorer nations can grow their economy sufficient to guarantee their citizens an adequate standard of living. But of course, what we've seen in the 20 or more years of the climate change process is the rich nations constantly shirk that responsibility and do everything they can to offload the responsibility back onto the global south.
We hear a lot of platitudes and promises from the developed world about doing something about the environment, the Paris Accords, these sorts of things that come out, but nothing much seems to change.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. The Paris Agreement in 2015, it's interesting that was celebrated in the media as a kind of, you know, a milestone commitment, which it was, rightly so. But behind that, the principle of common but differentiated responsibility, which is the principle that means that the poorer nations are given more time, more allowance, and the richer nations, you know, have the responsibility to do their fair share with the climate crisis and transfer resources and share, you know, that principle was actually increasingly undermined in the Paris Agreement and has been ever more so since. You know, we saw in the last climate change conference in Azerbaijan that the amount of money that's been offered in climate finance from the north to the south is really paltry. 300 billion, I think the figure was in the end. Most of it to come in the form of loans, once again, which would further indebt the economies of the global south. So we know firmly that sharing is at the heart of resolving the climate crisis and the wider ecological crisis. And yet it's been continually shirked ever more, to the point that we now, you know, you're going headlong into a disaster, particularly with the current US administration, you know, drill, baby, drill, the UK here opening more oil fields, another runway. It's a disastrous direction we're headed in.
I've read something on your website. Maybe it was from this piece that we've been talking about. If I get the words right, it said, commercialization is nothing less than a silent war against humanity's growth and evolution. So I want to ask you, what is the answer? You mentioned about mass protest, but how do we go about combating against this silent war?
Well, this really comes back to our founding campaign purpose, which is around Article 25 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which proclaims the right of everyone to an adequate standard of living for the health and well-being of themselves, their families, you know, food, the very basics, food, clothing, housing, medical care, social services, particular attention to motherhood and childhood, with needing special care and assistance. You know, these basic rights that were enshrined in 1948 are nowhere guaranteed in any country of the world, the richer or the poorer countries. So this is the basis of our campaign, is that we need to, you know, uphold Article 25. And that means mobilizing on that very basis, coming together in massive numbers and proclaiming the need, the right, that everyone should have their basic needs fulfilled. So it couldn't be simpler as a strategy, as a proposition. But within that, there's a lot that would need to happen and unfold. And this is the basis of the main book, by our campaign book, as it were, by Mohamed Mesbahi, called Heralding Article 25, A People's Strategy of World Transformation.
Yeah, I read a chapter out of that book before the interview, and one section it talks about how most countries' leaders are not in office for the people, but for corporations. And it talks about how we have to acknowledge why our governments have failed to guarantee the realization of these rights that are enshrined in Article 25. Can you speak to this idea about our leaders are there for the corporations?
Well, yeah, I think we've been talking around that a fair bit. And yeah, indeed. I mean, why is Article 25 unfulfilled? It's indeed because, I mean, the way Mohamed describes them in the book, he calls the politicians are political accountants, because their concern above all is with more contracts for big corporations and growing the economy. Their allegiance is not to fulfilling Article 25 and upholding the agencies of the United Nations to achieve that simple objective. You know, and we see it most vividly with geopolitics, American foreign policy specifically, And his book explores that a lot. So yeah, you know, people's rights above corporate rights are not the reality of the situation.
I think many people traditionally have tended to think about corporate influence, you know, and how they operate in society as separate from government influence and how they operate. But really, they are very strongly linked together, especially when it comes to the idea of commercialization and profit-driven activity.
Right. I mean, yeah, that's the fundamental basis of how the global economy is structured. You know, we know the power of corporations is greater than the power of any government. The amount of wealth that controls, the economy and is able to influence public policy. So yeah, I mean, this again comes back to why we need to unite much more in our societies and stand up for these most basic rights, because otherwise we'll see the continuation of these trends towards commercializing, privatizing everything, financializing everything, growing the stock market. You know, like our government right now in the UK is trying to do everything to just create growth by financializing pensions or whatever it can get its hands on. And that's what you have to do if you're going to try and please the business lobbies. And it's going to require a huge number of people standing up for basic rights if those trends are going to reverse and not lead us towards more disaster.
You're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina, and we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. And our guest today is Adam Parsons from Share the World's Resources in London. And we'll be back with Adam in just a few minutes after this break.
Yeah, the fabric of the soul is frayed and falling apart at the seams. I'm tied up and tied down by the strings of other people's dreams. I'm starting to see that that isn't me, and my freedom isn't free. But all I really want is soul to breathe. Someday I'll understand, no. I'll find a way to light in my load. The people take possession of the pieces of my weary heart. I'll learn to let go, whoa, and learn to say no. Like a lion lying down behind the bars of his cage. Yeah, the king of the beasts is now the king of this enclosed space. Wear and tear and worry, they've been drawing their lines on my face. Oh yes, sir. I feel a whole lot older than the chronological age.
Okay, welcome back. That's The Anthem of Mr. Dark, sung by Arcadian Wild from their album, Arcadian Wild. And today our guest on A Better World is Adam Parsons from Share the World's Resources, which is a UK-based organization working for a fair sharing of wealth, power, and resources within and between nations. And before the break, we were talking about a book from Sharing the World's Resources titled Heralding Article 25, A People's Strategy for World Transformation. Adam, in that book, it talks about American foreign policy. And I was wondering, can you talk about the link between how the UN has basically failed up to this point to realize Article 25 and the impact that American foreign policy has had on that failure?
Right. I mean, I think American foreign policy is, perhaps the principal cause for why the United Nations has been undermined over many years, and why countries of the global south have been further and further marginalized. I mean, that's really how the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have principally functioned in terms of, we know a lot about structural adjustment policies from the 1980s, and how indebted economies of the global south were forced to prioritize loan repayments over the basic needs of their citizens, to implement austerity policies and do everything to prioritize corporate interests. And so, you know, and of course, in terms of geopolitics, in terms of resource conflicts, you know, American foreign policy, as we see from the works of Noam Chomsky and so many others, is very much driving the divisive trends in the world. You know, we're seeing it barefaced now with the Trump administration almost advocating going back to, you know, 1900s colonial policies. So, yeah, I mean, you know, what it all comes down to is the fact that, you know, unless we do actually come together in massive numbers, as I come back to this theme, it's going to be impossible to change these trends. You know, of course, many activists are upholding these issues of, you know, ending sanctions, of stopping wars, of particularly like we see in Gaza now, of actually trying to uphold international law. And what they lack is numbers. You know, all of these protests lack sufficient numbers to make people, to make our governments change policy. Since the Iraq War onwards, we've seen that trend. And that's why we need protests that are much, much faster and continue daily and without cessation. We've seen the example of like the Occupy protests that would sit in and not go home. And that's the kind of response that we need now to deal with not just the crisis of geopolitical conflicts, ending wars, but also for ending poverty and dealing with the climate crisis.
And the protests that we saw during the Arab Spring as well. I mean, they were masses of numbers of people and sustained over a long time.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they were hugely inspirational, particularly like in Egypt, Tahrir Square, because what we saw is just how powerful a peaceful, united demand of the people can be. Of course, those demonstrations were focused on ending, you know, authoritarian regimes like Mubarak, and we saw how quickly that could happen. The results since then weren't great for Egypt, but it showed the power of people protesting together in a peaceful, non-violent manner. I'm sure you've heard of, you know, the 3.5 rule, based on the research that was in Harvard University that showed that, you know, a threshold of just 3.5% of the population engaged in non-violent mass protest has never failed to bring about transformational political change. And they were looking at hundreds of examples of people power type protests, including the Arab Spring. But the point is, it's about, as this book we're discussing, heralding Article 25, as it makes the case, it's about having a different kind of fundamental motive of protest, which is not just directed towards our national governments, but is also having an awareness of the fact that thousands of people are dying of hunger every day. There's a, you know, starvation is an unnecessary reality on our planet, and yet it continues daily and is growing. You know, the United Nations is facing an unprecedented humanitarian crisis, and this is what we are advocating. We need to see is huge mass protests proclaiming Article 25, an end to poverty, and the need for an international emergency relief program, which is directed towards empowering the United Nations and its frontline humanitarian agencies.
I mean, it's astounding when you hear about it. I just read, I think, some of the latest numbers, something like 9 million people a year die from hunger and hunger-related causes. We're nowhere near being able to alleviate that situation, I don't think.
And yet we could. You know, we know the what's needed. We know the policies that you know, there needs to be a massive structural changes, no doubt. But we know that, you know, there's no reason in any country why anyone has to suffer and die of poverty. And yet, yeah, as you say, I mean, the latest statistics is that there's about, 733 million people lack sufficient calories on a daily basis, but there's over 280 million people are in a state of chronic food insecurity, you know, chronic deprivation that is life-threatening almost. And yet, you know, as NGOs like Oxfam often point out, you know, the richest men in the world, like the three richest men who we saw at the US inauguration, have between them a combined wealth That's more than the bottom half of America, you know, almost $1 trillion. And so it's not a question of there not being enough wealth or resources. It's a question of redistribution and of the restructuring of economies and a change in political relations so that no one need die of hunger as a foremost human right relating to Article 25. And that sadly is a cause that is not what we see in the public sphere generally.
I appreciated what it said in the book about that it's a giant hypocrisy when heads of state attend these international conferences and profess to want to end human suffering and deprivation, while at the same time they continue to sign contracts with corporations to appropriate land and extract natural resources, often with devastating consequences for the very people that they profess to want to help.
Absolutely, absolutely. So yeah, it is a hypocrisy. And therefore it calls on us to stand up, you know, with these, you know, these intermittent meetings on ending global poverty by the G20, the G7, by, you know, like, not to decry the UN's sustainable development goals, which is the best we have in terms of an international commitment, woefully inadequate as it is, despite its supposed rhetoric of ending poverty and hunger, which is disingenuous, of course. But yeah, that's why it behoves us. You know, we should, as Mohammed writes in the book, Article 25, he says, you know, why don't we crowd into those summits and cry out that hypocrisy? Why don't we, in massive, massive numbers, millions, you know, point out to our politicians that this, you know, this, you are not meeting that, those goals of ending poverty. I mean, it's impossible to meet the SDGs on ending hunger by 2030 at this rate after the pandemic and the inflation that we've seen and the war in Ukraine and the energy price spikes. And, you know, there's no way on current trends we're going to meet those goals unless there's a complete reversal of international priorities. And without a massive engagement of popular will, it is simply not going to happen.
I asked you earlier about if the idea of sharing was based on any particular religious belief or religion. And this is kind of related to that question, but it seems to me that if we're ever going to be able to obtain a fair and equitable world for everyone, what we're missing is this realization that we are interconnected with other people. And if somehow we could latch on to that, it might inspire us to the streets, to mass protest, to, you know, hey, that's my brother, or that's my sister that's suffering over there. That's my child over there in the other part of the world that's suffering. Can you speak to that idea about the sense of interconnectedness and how that could possibly be a motivating factor for us?
Well, yeah, I think we were talking about the Occupy protest as a good example of people coming together in a mass and staying and not going home and for the benefit of others, of justice, of democracy, human rights, taking a stand. And what you saw in those kind of gatherings is this different energy, this more inclusive energy without, you know, as Mohammed puts it in the book, of without the thought of the me, you know, with when you're coming together with, in fact, I can quote, you know, he says, the fact of people demonstrating all over the world is in itself a form of spiritual or heart revolution that will be realized through the joyful awareness that humanity is one. The very sound of those demonstrations will be magnetized in such a way that they will constitute the first true spiritual revolution on this earth. A constant occurrence of worldwide uprisings in this manner will give such dignity and strength to people that we will look at each other without barriers of language, race, and class, as if we were always brothers and sisters, and as if trust had always been there, had we only chosen to use it. So he's talking about, you know, as you said, you know, this inclusive energy that we may experience through coming together in mass protest with an inclusive energy, particularly on behalf of ending mass poverty and hunger, which is something we have very little, you know, example of. There's been many NGO protests, you know, which happen on normally on a single day, on like a Saturday, the Jubilee movement, the Make Poverty History movement, even the charitable pop concerts that we've seen, like what Bob Geldof, you know, organized, well, back in the late 80s. I mean, you know, these are all for the good. But these are not the kind of spontaneous, leaderless actions like we saw with Occupy that need to come about on a permanent basis until our governments begin to change public policy towards an international emergency relief program, bringing back the kind of blueprint that was put down in the Brandt Report of 1980, which we talk a lot about in our work and publications, because that's perhaps the only example we have of a policy proposition to share the world's resources through massive transfers of resources from the global north to the global south.
And unfortunately, to my view, here in America, it seems like people aren't inspired to act until something hits them in their own purse, their own pocketbook. Then people get motivated to do something.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I was motivated to become involved in this work from my experience traveling, like in India, in Africa, in Nairobi and Kenya. I saw, you know, the example of how people who are the very poorest of the poor, how they often demonstrate sharing to the best example. You know, they share everything they have by necessity. And yet at whatever level you express sharing, it can bring that movement of joy, of togetherness. And so if we are to inject the principle of sharing internationally through the operations of our governments and through the coming together of millions of people for this cause of an international emergency relief program, I don't think we can imagine the kind of atmosphere that would create.
So are we talking about something more than what is being done by the work of the various charities of the world who are working in issues like hunger and poverty and saving the environment? Is it more than that?
So yeah, absolutely. I mean, well, we're talking really about empowering their work. I mean, for them, all of the NGOs like Oxfam, the Red Cross, you know, ActionAid, you name it, they are the lifeline for the poor. You know, if it wasn't for them, the United Nations frontline agencies, the world would be in such a poorer place. But if you had, I mean, but they also suffer from the lack of public engagement more than anyone. They have to use whatever means they have to try and raise funds, often using commercial tactics, you know. But if we had spontaneous demonstrations, people coming together in massive numbers and not going home until we see our governments making the kind of changes that are needed to distribute resources. You know, it is about aid, the right kind of aid from north to south and changing the current trends. Then, of course, it will be a breath of fresh air for the charities that exist. They don't want their work just to be reduced to charity. They want to see justice. I mean, any NGO worker would tell you that, I'm sure. And the World Food Programme, the other UN agencies that are doing such critical work, they are so tragically underfunded and they themselves are suffering from the lack of public input, the lack of support. It all comes back to, you know, ourselves, the actions that we're taking, rather than pointing towards our governments. And that's a theme that is again and again in the books by Mohamed Mesbahi. That it comes back to ourselves and how we are a part of the problem. We are the system. And therefore, unless we take action ourselves and join with others, then we cannot see a solution.
You mentioned a word just in your response there, the idea of justice. And it seems like that is a distinctly tied into this idea of sharing.
Absolutely. You know, sharing, justice, democracy, you know, all freedom. Mm-hmm. Human rights—they are, you know, they're interchangeable words, but there's a lot more. There's a lot more to sharing as a principle because it's evolutionary, it's foundational. I mean, even these words, justice, are kind of human-made words, man-made, whereas sharing is a principle of evolution that is infinite. You know, it will never end, and so we need to integrate that principle through our economy, through our world economy, to see how that will evolve. To see how new forms of non-profit-based, equitable economic exchange may lead to different societies. But it has to begin when everyone has their basic needs met, which is a goal which is viable technically, you know, financially. We know we can achieve that goal. And unless we do, not only will we no longer see the continued evolution of our life on this planet, but we will not know what we have in front of us. You know, the possibilities of what, you know, our human life is all about.
That's Adam Parsons. He's with Share the World's Resources in London, and he's our guest today on A Better World. And you're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina.
Crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds dismal. Poor people gonna rise up and get their share.
Okay, that's Tracy Chapman singing Talking About a Revolution from her album, Tracy Chapman. Today on A Better World, our guest is Adam Parsons from the UK-based Share the World's Resources. Adam, we hear a lot these days about this idea of a sharing economy. Is what you're talking about with sharing the same as this idea of a sharing economy?
Well, it depends how you define that. There's another book by Mohamed Mizbahi called The Sharing Economy, Inaugurating an Age of the Heart. And he explores this in some depth. We took an interest in the idea of a sharing economy when that really took off around, it was in the wake of the Occupy protests that we were talking about and the anti-austerity mobilizations around, 2013, 2014. And the idea, it became a kind of the new zeitgeist all of a sudden. People were talking about the sharing economy, but there were these two competing visions of that. On the one hand, there were those who were kind of rejecting materialistic attitudes and perceiving the way for a different way of organizing society based on connectedness and sharing, you know, rather than ownership and conspicuous consumption. But the other idea of sharing, which is more entrepreneurial and based on, you know, revenue growth, shareholder value maximization, you know, this idea of business, basically using phone apps and stuff to connect. This is very much more to do with further commercialization of our societies than truly sharing in the way we would understand that as a principle, even a divine principle, as we've been talking about. So we try to engage with that debate and influence it in a more broadened way to include, you know, the more public political ideas of sharing. You know, the fact that perhaps the best examples of sharing we have, sharing national sharing economies, is publicly funded social services. You know, like the National Health Service in the UK, however much it's being eroded. You know, the fact of, you know, decent tax and spend systems where you have progressive taxation in order to fund public services, universal social protection. These are examples of sharing. And our perspective is that, of course, you have to inject that principle globally. So you have a proper global sharing economy, which would mean that, you know, the United Nations is empowered in the right way so that it has all the resources and funding it needs to, you know, to deliver global public goods, to make sure people have their basic needs secured in every country. So that's where we were coming from it. And what was interesting about the book by Mohamed Mizbahi on this subject, he also looks at the inner aspects as well as the outer aspects, the more psychological, spiritual aspects of this. And he has a lot to say on that.
Getting towards the end of our time together, but just a couple more questions. Does Share the World's Resources, do you get any kind of coverage from mainstream media about your work?
I wish we had more. We do interviews like with yourself now, McNair. Mm-hmm. We do interviews time to time. We do host events and do lots. And we join with other events and protest movements. But the mainstream media as a whole, of course, is not even profiling the work of even like the major NGOs sufficiently. We once took out full-page national adverts, and it was geared at one of the G8 meetings. This was back in, 2009, eight, I think, around the time of the global financial crisis. We thought surely then we would get some response from the mainstream media, but we didn't. We really didn't. It was from people in ordinary folk, but no. I mean, there's not enough focus on this. But again, that shows you why the media are not going to respond to the idea of sharing, which is antithetical to the interests of their corporate benefactors. Mm-hmm. So unless people themselves begin to grasp this cause and talk about the need to share the world's resources, unless this becomes a household discussion, in the same way as the climate crisis is, even that's not enough of a discussion. You know, it's a double crisis. The way we treat the climate change as an emergency, we need to treat the crisis of life-threatening deprivation and hunger-related deaths as a global emergency and act on that basis, as if we have to do everything we can to stop people dying now, today. And we are sorely lacking that sentiment in public affairs and have been for many decades.
Does your faith in humanity's ability to solve the hunger and poverty and other issues, does it ever waver?
I have always faith that we are capable of averting the serious crises that are facing the world. I do believe that, like these findings we spoke about, the scientific findings, that people are innately good. And if we are shown a different way, and especially if we come together and unify, then this sense of who we are beyond our limited notion of self can be expressed and felt experientially. You know, different religions talk about the heart as a real factor in our modes of being. In Christianity, it talks about the Christ principle. And I do believe that through an expansion of our awareness and a coming together, through unifying with others with a common cause, which is larger than ourselves, we can also feel the Christ principle in operation. And I think that quality, that energetic quality of the heart, when it's released, is one of the most important factors when you're talking about changing the world.
So for people who might be listening and want to get involved with Share the World's Resources, how might they do so?
Well, they can certainly engage with our website, our social media networks. We hope that they will read the book, particularly our campaign book, Heralding Article 25, and talk about that. And, you know, right now, people often say to us, well, it's not happening. There aren't these protests. So what am I supposed to do? Well, you can... You know, we ourselves are the spark. You know, we can take this on whatever level we can, talk about it, create discussion groups, book groups. We do, you know, our own sort of grassroots campaigns. You can get involved with those, postcard campaigns, advertising. There's, you know, talks. You can do your own talks, join our talks. There's a, you know, limitless things you can do. But you need to become infused by this idea, by the possibility of this campaign. You need that vision. An understanding, you know, you need to have your heart engagement, and there's, you know, many things that you can do. We have co-workers around many different countries in the USA also, who are doing various things. So yeah, we hope that more people will get involved.
So give the website one more time.
The website is www.sharing.org, and you can find us also on Facebook, on Twitter X, and Instagram. And there's lots of publications that we have on our website and introductory materials.
Okay, on that note, I want to thank Adam Parsons from UK-based Share the World's Resources for coming on the show today. Adam, thank you so much, and all the best to you.
Thank you, Munir. Thanks so much for speaking to me.
You've been listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we've been streaming live at WPVMFM.org. This is McNair Ezard. Thank you for joining us, and hopefully we'll see you next time on A Better World. And we're going out today with Layup singing Who You Share It With.
It's joy in who you share it with. Joy in.